Hello there, and welcome to episode number 4 of the Dow of Tech podcast, Tech Lust and Tech Left in the Dust. The Dow of Tech is going to be your weekly dose in the way of technology. Episodes will be featuring the weekly geeky goings-on of me, your host, Mark Prestash. Shows will generally focus on a couple of tech topics a week, including software, hardware, and everything tech-related from the coolest geek toys to the best in podcast novels. Now, as you may have guessed based on the show title, this week's show we're going to be talking about some rather lust-worthy tech products, in my opinion, as well as some products I don't think are worth your tech time and money. Now, before we begin, I have 3 quick things I would like to bring up. The first thing is I want to apologize for this episode being so late. I've been trying to improve the audio quality of the podcast, and it's been a lot harder than I thought it would be. I've actually recorded this episode, I think, 3 or 4 times trying to get it just right. I've been getting help from my friend Ken Crawford, who is the author of the awesome podcast novel Dead Hunt. So if the audio in this podcast sounds better than the previous ones, you can thank Ken Crawford for that. If it still doesn't sound all that great, then I guess there's no one to blame but me for that. So that's why the episode is late. I do apologize, but I'm trying to make it better overall for you guys, the listeners. So hang in there, stay with me, and again, I appreciate you guys sticking with me and putting up with the late episode. The second thing I want to bring up real quick is about the last episode of the Dow of Tech, titled Act Out Against ACTA, which was all about the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. If you recall, this is a treaty that was being negotiated in secret between the U.S. and several countries that had some pretty draconian ideas about fair use and the role of your ISP in this here brave new world. That show was based on leaked documents of the ACTA treaty, and one of my major complaints was up to that point the documentation that we had was somewhat of really a mystery because all the information that we had was based on leaked documents. Well, as of April 22nd, 2010, the European Commission has released the full text of the treaty in PDF form for everyone to review. So if you have any interest in checking out the full text of the ACTA treaty, point your browsers to http://trade.ec.europa.eu. Again, trade.ec.europa.eu. Now, once you get to that main page, you want to select the document search link in the upper right-hand corner of that main page. That's going to take you to another page where you can search for documents. You want to enter in the keyword ACTA, A-C-T-A, and the very first result that you should get should be the full version of the ACTA treaty text in the PDF format. Definitely go over there and check out the text of the treaty if you have any interest in looking more into what the treaty has to say. Now, on a related note, I'd also mention in episode 3 that if you were as angry with the internet section of the ACTA treaty as I was, I had said, you know, hey, contact your senators and contact your other elected officials and let them know your thoughts on ACTA. Well, I had sent emails to both of my senators, and I actually got a response back today from one of my senators, Joseph Lieberman. And something he said back to me in his response really kind of took me back for a second. He said to me in his letter that his understanding of ACTA was that it was an executive agreement and not a standard treaty. My understanding of an executive agreement, just based on what I looked up really quickly on Wikipedia today, was that an executive agreement is something that the president enters into treaty-wise with other countries, but doesn't require the Senate to actually ratify the treaty for it to go into law. So at this point, it sounds like the senators really aren't even going to get to vote on the ACTA treaty as it is currently being negotiated. I still think that you should contact your elected officials, let them know your thoughts about the ACTA treaty. They can then put pressure on President Obama, and we can try to get this thing to a reasonable point of where fair use is something that is not completely destroyed by the treaty, where we don't make our ISPs government watchdogs for IP. That's all I have to say about the ACTA treaty again. The last thing I want to bring up before we actually get into the show is I want you to stay tuned after the show because I'm playing another kick-ass audio podcast drama promo. This week, I'm going to be playing the promo for HG World. You may recall HG World as one of the podcasts that I listened to and I was very excited about. So I want you guys to listen to the promo and check it out for yourselves as well. Just a quick little FYI. HG World follows the interwoven story arcs of survivors in a zombie apocalypse. The writers weave in topics of faith, the nature of man, there's a little bit of romance, there's a whole lot of mystery, and there's some downright nasty zombie action. So please stay tuned after the show, after I say goodbye, after the closing music, because after all of that is going to be the promo for HG World. If you listen to the promo and you are interested in hearing more of the show, you can find HG World on iTunes simply by searching for HG World, or you can head over to their website, which is www.goodmorningsurvivors.com. On their website, you can listen to episodes there as well. They have a forum section. If you have any interest in doing any audio work, they will post roles and character voices that they need. They have a wiki there as well. So now if you check out HG World and you dig it as much as I do, please do me a favor and let them know that you heard about HG World from the Dow of Tech podcast. I love audio podcasts, and I want these authors and these content creators to know that the Dow of Tech is a good place for people to go to learn about cool new podcasts, audio dramas, and books that are out there. So you can join the forums and leave a message for them there. If you're on Twitter, you can contact them there as well. The writer of the show is twitter.com/jandrewsmith, or you can also leave a message with the HG World account, which would be twitter.com/HG_world. If you're not on Twitter or you're not inclined to join the message boards over there, but you're on Facebook, they also have a Facebook fan page as well. So just look for the fan page on Facebook. Leave them a message, tell them, hey, I'm new to the show, I heard the promo on the Dow of Tech podcast. Just let them know that you heard about them from me. I would appreciate that very much, so thank you. All right, now that we've gotten through all of the little things I wanted to discuss before we actually got into the show, it is time to talk about some lust-worthy gadgets. Now, the first gadget on my list was originally the HTC Nexus One cell phone on Verizon. This was a pretty badass looking cell phone running the Android 2.1 operating system. It just looked like a really, really awesome phone. However, recently Google in a blog post said that if you're in the US and you've been waiting for the Nexus One on Verizon, they suggested that you head over and pre-order the HTC Droid Incredible, which will be on Verizon, because as they say, that it is a similarly feature-packed cell phone. Apparently, the Nexus One is either not going to be coming out on Verizon at all, or it's going to be so long for it to come out, it just ain't worth the wait. So, my new number one lust-worthy tech product is, in fact, the HTC Droid Incredible for Verizon. It's actually out now, as of this recording, and it is running the Android 2.1 version of the operating system, which is Eclair, in case you were wondering. The Droid Incredible has an 8-megapixel camera. It has an optical mouse to help you navigate websites. They've updated the Sense UI feature with a feature they call Leap, which is a way of handling the multitasking abilities of the phone. A lot of reviewers have said that it is very reminiscent of Palm's WebOS deck of cards. Basically, you pinch anywhere on the home screen, and you're going to jump to a 7-thumbnail view of all of your open apps. And from there, you can go into any of them and close them, bring them up, or whatever else it is that you want to do with your apps. It comes out of the box with 8 gigabytes of internal storage, which can be upgraded to 16 gigabytes via a micro SD card. The phone also has built-in Wi-Fi as well. I'm fairly certain it will have B and G Wi-Fi capabilities. I've also seen, but have not been able to confirm, it might actually support Wi-Fi Draft N. If it has the Draft N, that is totally freaking badass that a cell phone has Draft N Wi-Fi built into it. That's just awesome. Now, the phone itself has got a 3.7-inch 480 by 800 OLED touchscreen. The idea of the OLED screen, I think, is appealing to me because the display does not actually require a backlight for it to actually be very bright and very easy to see. So because it doesn't have the backlight, it can display very deep black levels. The OLED screen is actually thinner than your typical LCD panel. The OLED screen actually displays a much higher contrast ratio than most LCD screens do as well. Now, the HTC Droid Incredible is a fully touchscreen phone, so there's no physical keyboard, so they obviously give you a virtual QWERTY keyboard. There's also integrated Google, Facebook, and Exchange contacts. It supports push email for Gmail and Exchange clients, and it also has a pretty badass speech-to-text recognition software. Basically, any field on the phone where you could potentially type in text, you can actually speak that text into that field. It also does speech searches as well. So if you want to do a search on something, say you wanted to do a search for a pizza place, you could just say nearest pizza place or pizza restaurants with your zip code, and it'll look it up based on what you have said. The phone also features pinch to zoom and multi-touch features. It supports unprotected AAC, AAC+, EAAC+, WMA, and MP3 audio files as well. I wasn't really able to determine what image file formats the phone would support, but if it's anything like the Nexus One, it supported something like 6 or 7 different image formats, including JPEG, TIFF, and GIF, if I recall. So the phone looks pretty freaking badass. Now, if you're on Verizon and your contract is up, you are lucky, because you can have this phone for $200 with a 2-year contract. If you're unlucky, like me, and your contract doesn't expire for another 4 months with Verizon, the phone's going to cost you $500. I think for all the features and the functions of the phone, I think it's definitely worth the $500. I'm tempted to wait the 4 months, but I really, really hate my current cell phone, which is the LG Dare. This phone just makes my current phone look like a rotary dial phone. The more I look at it, the more I despise my current cell phone. So go check out the HTC Droid Incredible on the Verizon website. They have a lot of cool features and little interactive movies that you can check out the functions of the phone. Check it out for yourself and see what you think. Now, the next super lustful item that I have on my list is the Boxy Box. Currently, Boxy is software that you download to your PC that provides an interface for viewing video content from across the web, as well as the content you have on your PC. The software provides a portal to view the content from the Boxy player instead of going to multiple websites to watch the content that you want to see. So instead of going to ABC and CBS and NBC's website or YouTube or wherever else, you can view their content within the Boxy player. It's a phenomenal way to view video content from multiple sources. Now, a lot of people have actually put the Boxy software on a laptop, and they just plug their laptop into their TV, and they watch the video on their TV. It seems like it works fine. I haven't really heard a lot of complaints or problems with people doing it. I don't do it for a couple reasons. One, I don't have a spare laptop to do that. Plus, I don't think it's the most kid-friendly setup to have. I think my 8-year-old might be able to figure it out. I don't think my 4-year-old daughter could really figure out what to do. That would require me to actually do everything for her, and that's just not a whole lot of fun for me. So the solution that I see is the Boxy Box, which is going to be a consumer electronics device made by D-Link that integrates the Boxy software with a set-top box that you just plug directly into your TV. Now, the Boxy Box will have all the features of the current Boxy software, but just on your TV without the laptop in the middle. The set-top Boxy Box player, once installed, you plug it in, and with the remote that they include in the box, you search for the content off of the main page, you choose what you want, and you watch it. It's also going to provide links to paid video sites like Amazon, Netflix, and Blockbuster. Now, besides providing the interface for viewing the content of all these different websites, the Boxy Box will also play the movies and music you have on your PC currently. Now, according to the website, the Boxy Box plays any non-DRM'd media. They say if you can create it, Boxy will play it, which I think is really cool because I have music in 3 or 4 different formats. I've got movies in 2 or 3 different formats, none of them DRM'd, so it's nice to be able to have a player that will just grab it and play it with no fuss, no muss. I use the Boxy software on my PC now, and it plays everything I have thrown at it. The only thing, again, it won't play would be anything that has DRM in it, which really isn't a whole lot for me because I really didn't buy much content that has built-in DRM. One of the cool features of the Boxy Box is the remote itself. On the back side of the remote, it features a full keyboard. So anything that is not already listed on the Boxy page, you can just type the URL and off you go to the site. Now, the Boxy Box has an HDMI connection, it has optical audio, it has RCA stereo audio, it's got built-in Wi-Fi, which is 802.11n, thank you very much. It has a built-in Ethernet port, 2 USB ports, an SD card slot, and again, that RF remote with the QWERTY keyboard on the back. Now, we're expecting the Boxy Box to come in around $200, and it's supposed to be out sometime in 2010. If you go to the website, they don't give you a date, so I can't give you a date myself. And the price is something that I believe hearing from CES, where I saw a presentation, and that's the number that sort of stuck out in my head is what they're going to be asking for the Boxy Box. Now, if you're interested in the Boxy software, or if you want to see more about the Boxy Box, just go over to www.boxy.tv for more details. Alright, so those are the two most lust-worthy tech products I have on my mind right now. Next, we're going to be talking about two products that I'm hemming and I'm hawing on. I'm not sure I want them, I don't want them, there's pros, there's cons. So these are gadgets that I might want to get sometime in the future. Now, the first gadget that I might want to get is going to be the iPad. I'm sure many of you might be surprised that it's not my number one want on my gadget list, but it really isn't, because I'm not quite sure about the iPad yet. Here's the thing. There's no doubt that the device is compelling. There's no doubt about it. The screen is gorgeous. I mean, it's a 9.7-inch diagonal screen. It plays back 720p content. It has the iBook Store. It has all of the apps from the iTunes Store in there. It has apps that have been designed just for the larger screen. Some people have sort of poo-pooed the idea of the iPad as just being a large iPod or iPhone, but I think that's awesome because I love my iPod Touch, so the idea of a larger one doesn't sound like a bad thing to me. But I gotta say, though, I'm still not 100% sold on the device. The first thing comes down to price. The iPad comes in two flavors. There's a Wi-Fi only model, and there's a Wi-Fi plus 3G model. The sizes are 16, 32, and 64 gigabytes, and the prices are $499, $599, and $699 for the Wi-Fi only, whereas the Wi-Fi plus 3G models come in at $629, $729, and $829 for the 16, 32, and 64 gigabyte models. I don't know about you guys, but my media library in iTunes right now is pushing 20 plus gigs right off, just without adding anything to it right now. So right off the bat, that eliminates the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi and 3G models right off the top. Just, you know, I want to have all my content on it, so I can't have the 16-gigabyte model. Now, the next model is 32 gigabytes of storage. Now, that may seem like a pretty good number. I mean, it's only $600 and $729 for the Wi-Fi model. But because my content is so close to pushing and exceeding that 32-gigabyte limit, I really see myself as only having the option of buying the 64-gigabyte version, which is either $700 for just the Wi-Fi or $829 for the Wi-Fi plus 3G. So I think the first thing that makes me sort of think twice about getting the iPad is the price. I'm looking at either $699 or $829, depending on whether I get the Wi-Fi or I get the Wi-Fi plus the 3G model. Now, the Wi-Fi plus 3G is even more money then, because the 3G plan you have to pay for separately. It's either, I think it's $15 for 250 megabytes or $30 for an unlimited 3G service for the iPad. And that's just one more bill a month that I don't think I really want to pay. At least, I mean, I can't afford to do that right now. So I don't really think that the 3G model is really an option for me, which means I would be, quote unquote, stuck with the Wi-Fi only model. And I'm not sure I want just the Wi-Fi only, because I have this thing with my iPod where I love my iPod, but really I can only use it in places where I have Wi-Fi for all the other things it does besides just play music. Now, another thing that kind of makes me pause about buying an iPad is that there have been a couple of well-respected tech journalists who I follow that have bought iPads and returned them, most notably Molly Wood and Gina Trapani. Their concerns, and I think my concerns, are fairly similar, so I'm not going to mention their issues in particular. I think I'm just going to sort of mesh them into my other concerns about the product. I think the lack of flash support on the device, it's just ridiculous, I think, in my opinion. I know that Steve Jobs recently just came out with a letter explaining his reasons why they don't put Flash on their devices. I don't think I buy them 100%. I hear what he's saying, but I'm hearing a lot of FUD in the middle of a couple of good points. I guess I look at it like this, is that I understand that Apple thinks that HTML5 is the wave of the future, and I get that they want to be forward-thinking, but you also have to be, I think, compliant with the current standards that are being used today. And I think not supporting a current standard such as Flash, I think, is a fault of the device. There's also no camera on this thing. There's no USB ports. There's no media card slots. There have been problems reported with the Wi-Fi having a very weak signal, which I can relate to as well. My iPod Touch does the exact same thing. The Wi-Fi, it just kind of, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. So I can see this being a trend with the Apple products. I think the other thing, too, that makes me hesitant about the iPad is that you have to live in the Apple walled garden ecosystem. Now, I know that I'm currently living within that walled garden with my iPod Touch, and so far it really hasn't bit me in the butt, except for the Flash support, but I can really see someday that I would have an issue knowing that something isn't allowed in the store or something I can't do with the device simply because Apple doesn't want me to do it. I think that's one of the reasons why I don't run a Mac, I run a PC, is because I can pretty much do anything to, with, and for my computer that I want to do and I can actually accomplish, good, bad, or indifferent. And I like that ability to do that. I think the difference between the iPad and the iPod is the price, and I think for that price, I think I should be able to do more with it. Yeah, sure, I guess you could hack it if you want to, but I don't know that I really want to do that. Now, I'm also unsure of the iBook store. I really don't know how much content is going to be available right off the bat and in the next 6 months. I'm not sure what the cost of books are going to be. I've also heard that the iPad is heavy. It comes in at 1.5 pounds, which doesn't really sound all that much. But from everything I've been hearing, if you're holding this thing for any length of time, you know, your arms get tired. It's sort of awkward. There really doesn't seem to be a comfortable position to hold the device for any length of time. And I've also heard that the typing on it is not all that great either. It seems to be rather good at quick and short emails, but anything lengthy, this is not the device to draft those long-form emails on. So those are my thoughts on the iPad. Compelling, no doubt about it. Pricey for sure, and definitely some negatives, I think, that are associated with purchasing the device. Now, the next device that I'm going to be talking about as a potential buy is an ebook reader. I love to read, And I've been reading ever since I was a kid. I read comics as a kid, I moved up, I got better, and as an adult I'm reading 1,200-page books on J. Edgar Hoover. I have a large collection of hardcover and softcover books that I like to display on my bookshelf, and I'm pretty proud of the fact that I've read pretty much every book on that bookshelf. If somebody came into my house and said, hey, what's that book about? I could probably tell you about that book. But here's the thing, though. I'm kind of getting tired of the physical ownership of things, and I'm kind of getting ready to move over to a digital ownership of things. It's nice having a lot of books on a bookshelf, but they take up a lot of space. The ebook reader really is a great way to eliminate a lot of space for a lot of physical things in my house. I guess the problem is that I'm still not sold 100% on the current generation of ebook readers. Now, for this podcast, I'm really only going to be talking about the Amazon Kindle and the Barnes & Noble Nook. Now, I know there's others out there from other manufacturers, but I didn't want to get too many in there because I think that they're fairly similar enough that they would all generally have the same pros and cons. One may be better at one thing than another, but I think overall this topic really speaks to the general issues I have with them as a whole. I'm really using the Kindle and the Nook as just sort of points of comparison and things to discuss really in the podcast here. As far as weight goes, they're both pretty light little devices. The Kindle comes in at about 10 ounces and the Nook weighs about 12. They're both ebook and e-ink readers. I think part of my issue right off the bat is that they're really only single-purpose devices. They really are only ebook readers. And I'm not saying that everything has to have a multifunction, a multipurpose, but I think that these devices could do more, and that would add more value to the product. While the Nook does use the e-ink display for the actual book reading itself, they do add in a color touchscreen at the bottom of the reader that allows you to browse the book covers and make your purchases of the book from that little bottom layer down there. But I think that's a bit of a tease. You know, you see the book cover in color, but then when you buy it, it's all in black and gray. So who really freaking cares that you saw the book cover in red or blue or green? It seems like a gimmick to me, and I just don't think it's really necessary or purposeful to do that. I'm sure that the touchscreen is used for other things as well. I know that there was a recent update that I think added some browsing ability on the web on the device as well, but I mean, again, the screen is so freaking small. I mean, how good could it be, I guess, is the way I look at it. Both of these readers hold about 1,500 books out of the gate with their 2 gigs of onboard memory. Nook, however, can expand their memory, and it can hold actually more books if you add yourself in a little SD card there. Now, they're both coming in at $259 for the 6-inch models, the Kindle and the Nook. Amazon also makes a larger version of the Kindle ebook reader at a 9.7-inch screen, but the price is $489. Now, you get a bigger screen, it holds more books at up to around 3,500 books, but at $489, that's $10 less than the lowest model iPad. So I have to eliminate the 9.7-inch DX right off the bat, because even though I wouldn't necessarily want the 16-gigabyte iPad, for $10 more, why wouldn't I get that over the Kindle DX? Because the iPad at that point still does do ebooks, and it does a million other things that the DX doesn't do. So I have to eliminate the DX right off the bat, simply based on price. Now, the number of books available on both of these platforms is pretty compelling. The Kindle has about 500,000 books that you can buy and about 1.8 million that are free. And these are out-of-print books that you can download as well. The Nook has the power of the Barnes & Noble book chain behind it. So they claim to have over 1 million books that you can download, plus the free books that you can download as well that are these out-of-print and public domain books as well. So I think the Nook has probably the edge in the number of books that you can purchase and you can download from them, which is nice. Now, the Nook also lets you download a portion of the book before you buy it to see if you like it. And the Nook also supports more file formats like EPUB and a few others, more so than the Kindle does. The Kindle seems to be a little bit locked down in that sense. So I think the number of books on both of these platforms is rather compelling. I think it's one of those things like, wow, that's a lot of books. That's 500,000 to a million books. You're going to find something new that you want to read. But then when you think about it, you have to move on then to the cost of the book. Now, the books used to be cheaper. Amazon was selling these books for about $10 for new books. And all of a sudden, the publishers said, wait a second, we're not making enough money off of this. And they restructured their deal with Amazon, and the books are back up to about $15 or more for new books. So why would I buy the same book for $15 on the Kindle when I could buy it for the same amount of money or less in the paperback? I mean, yeah, sure, there's the portability and you know, whatever. I understand that. But at that point in time, I would almost rather have the paper book. Part of the value, I think, of the ebook reader is that, you know, the book itself should be cheaper. You're not paying for the paper. You're not paying for the printing. You're not paying for the physical delivery costs. You're not paying for the storage of those books in the warehouse of the publisher. So all these costs that are built into the price of a new physical book apparently are also being built in now to the ebooks. So the ebook is essentially propping up the failing physical book market, which I just think is a bunch of crap. I think that the ebook should be cheaper than the physical, and the fact that the prices of these books are, in a lot of cases, very similar to the physical cost of the book, it just doesn't add up for me. So I think that the price of books has to come down on these devices before I can really seriously consider buying one of these e-readers. Now, say I get one of these e-readers. Now, getting the books is easy as hell. The Kindle uses the Sprint 3G connection to download books rather speedily, from what I understand. The Nook has built-in Wi-Fi as well as built-in 3G coverage, but the coverage is through AT&T, so, you know, I guess I'm just going to let that one hang out there for a second. It's AT&T 3G coverage. Now, the Nook also lets you buy books from inside a Barnes & Noble bookstore, but I think that almost defeats the purpose of having an ebook reader that has built-in Wi-Fi and 3G coverage. I mean, unless you're actually at the mall with your ebook reader, why would you get in your car and drive to the mall or drive to the bookstore, which could be God knows how far away? I mean, for me, it's 40 minutes, 45 minutes away. Why would I drive 45 minutes away to go walk around a Barnes & Noble store to download a book from within the store and then drive back home? It just seems, again, it seems, the idea, I guess, I can see it, but I think in practice it just seems goofy. I just don't see where that's really a benefit. Like I said, unless you have the ebook reader with you and you happen to be at the mall, I don't really see very many people going around and making a trip to the bookstore to download a book from the store, from being inside the store. I just don't see it. I guess the one thing I can see, if you're not sure about what book you want to get, you can walk around the store and take a look and get the name and the titles, and from walking around the store and looking at the selection, I guess that could help you decide what book that you want. But I don't know, I usually have a pretty good idea what book I want to get. I've heard about it, I've seen reviews on it, a friend has read it, so usually I'm looking for something in particular as opposed to I'm just browsing. You know, I mean, usually I walk in knowing what I'm looking for. I think one of the nice things about the Nook is that they do allow you to share a book that you have on your reader with a friend. Now, this is only allowed on certain books, so once again, the publisher has the right to say yes or no to this, and the book can only be shared for up to 14 days. But here's where the book sharing goes from a really good idea to being, I think, poorly executed at best. Say you and I both have Nooks, and you want one of the books I have, and I say, sure, here you go, I'm sharing the book with you, you've got 14 days. Since I've shared the book with you, I can't read that book now. because you have the book. Now, I think that's ridiculous. Sure, you could say, okay, Mark, well, if I wanted to borrow a book from you, you couldn't read that book because you gave me the physical book. Yeah, that's true, but that's a physical book. This is a digital file. This is something that can be transferred, copied, manipulated, any number of ways that a book couldn't ever be dealt with. So there's really no reason why I shouldn't or couldn't be able to read that exact same book that I let you borrow at the same time that you're reading it. What if we want to discuss the book? It would be nice if that person could read the book at the same time I was, and we could have a conversation about it or whatever. I think that the sharing is a great idea. I think that the way that they're doing it, I think, is kind of piss poor. Other thing about the sharing is that it has to be nook to nook. But now, what really are the odds that you and a friend are both going to have nooks? I think that's pretty freaking low. So, you know, I mean, again, it's sort of like the Zune and the squirting. Great idea, I suppose, you know, to share the music and have people check it out and whatever. But again, how many people had Zunes that you know? I mean, I know of one person that has a Zune. One person. And I know a lot of other people that have a lot of other different MP3 players that are not Zunes. So really, the function is great, but if no one else has them, then it's really kind of useless and worthless. Now, one of the things I think obtains to both of these e-readers is that when you buy a book for one of these e-readers, it's really yours forever. There's no way to resell it. There's no way to let a friend really borrow it for any real length of time without giving them your e-book reader, which I don't think you're going to do. Today, if you go out and buy a hardcover book, you can go to a bookstore and sell it used. You can give it to the library. You can let your friend borrow it for 2 years and say, who cares? Because I've already read it. I'll get it back whenever I get it back. But with these digital devices, you are the owner and that's it. There's no resale right. And that's something that I think is a bit of a crying shame, because I think that's one of the wonderful things about a physical book is I can say to my friend, hey, you might like this book. Check it out. Yeah, I'm reading something, but I'll get to it. Sure, you know, here you go. Read it. Give it back to me whenever. Or, you know, I've read it. I've lent it out to as many friends as I can lend it out to. I'm running out of space on my bookshelf. I think I'm going to sell it. And that's that. You go off and you sell it. You can't do that with these things. It's a digital file that you can't get off that thing, and you can't give it to somebody else. You can't sell it to somebody else. That's it. It's on the device, and you can't do anything else with it other than read it. And once you've read it, what else are you really going to do with it? And I think the last thing that sort of makes me pause about ebook readers is I really want a device that has better web access on it. I'm not saying that it's a necessity to be able to browse the web on this device. But I guess what I'm saying is that having a working browser on the device would go a long way to adding more value to the ebook reader. I think certain things are fine as a single function device. I think the ebook reader is one of them, but I think adding more functionality is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, if you're reading something, you're, you know, hey, that pokes a something in your brain there, you get curious, you want to look something up. I mean, right now you'd have to stop, walk over to your laptop, walk over to your desktop, do a search, whatever, pull up a page. If they had the browser on the device, you'd be spending more time on the device. You'd be using it way more, and I think a good browsing experience would definitely add more value to the device. So that's it for gadgets that I kind of want to get. So we've covered the things I am lusting for, the HTC Droid Incredible and the BoxyBox, the couple of gadgets that I might want to get, which would be the iPad and an ebook reader. Now we're going to talk about the one gadget that I really just don't want to get at all, and I just really hope it just flat out goes away as quickly as possible. Now, what device could possibly cause me to say that kind of thing about it? Well, it's 3D TV. I gotta say, people, I have no freaking desire to watch 3D TV. I have no desire to watch 3D TV in my house. I have no desire to watch 3D TV in a bar. I just don't care about 3D TV. I look at 3D TV as sort of like the laser disc of the TV industry. I think it's going to be around for a little while. I think it's going to die a slow and painful death, but eventually it will just go away and people will forget about it as quickly as they possibly can. Why do I have so much bleh for 3D TV? Well, I'll tell you why. First, I wear glasses, and I have an astigmatism. So I do see 3D, but I don't think I get the full range and depth of 3D that other people get, which I think is partially due to the astigmatism. The astigmatism has been known to cause issues in people's ability to view 3D. That's just the way my eyes work. So I think right off the bat, there's a somewhat of a physical limitation. I think number two, that the content is not there. And yeah, I understand right now that it's sort of like the early days of HD programming where there really wasn't a whole lot out there, but over time it builds up. I get that. But I just don't think that there are going to be that many things that are going to be shot in true 3D that will make it worthwhile to have this 3D TV. I mean, the movies that come out are basically kid movies, I mean, with the exception of Avatar and a couple of others. The movies that I've seen really, I gotta say, the 3D isn't really all that compelling to me. So it's not like the stuff in the movie theater is like, oh gosh, I gotta go home and watch that on my 3D TV. You know, sports programming, I think, might be the exception. I think sports in 3D could be pretty cool to watch. But I mean, I know that a lot of content is really just 2D content that's been converted over into 3D. So it's not like it's really even true 3D contents. It's converted stuff. So it's not going to look very good at all. It's going to look like, I think Clash of the Titans is an example where they didn't film it in 3D. They filmed it in 2D. They converted the movie into 3D and it looks like shit. You know, I'm not too sold on the content. I think the next thing that really sort of spoils me on 3D TV is that now I gotta go out and buy a whole new frickin' TV set. And I don't really feel like dropping another $2,000 or $3,000 on a TV set just to get 3D. It doesn't seem like what I'm getting out of it is worth the money that I'm spending. It just doesn't compel me enough to say, I gotta spend that much money to get that 3D TV. It just doesn't get... doesn't compel me enough. And I guess lastly, really, is just several rants I have about the glasses themselves. I just can't get over them. I find it very uncomfortable to wear 3D glasses over a long period of time because I'm wearing the 3D glasses over my regular glasses. And that causes pressure, and that causes pain, and sometimes the glasses, they slide, so the 3D glasses may be lower on my nose than my regular glasses, so it's sort of like this blurry 3D kind of mishmash of whatever. So wearing the glasses for me, I think, is very uncomfortable. I think the cost of the glasses is ridiculous. I think some sets are coming with a pair of 3D glasses. However, there are other sets from other manufacturers where you have to buy a separate pair of glasses. Why would you buy a 3D TV and not, for the love of God, throw in a pair of 3D glasses to watch the freaking 3D TV content? I mean, come on. So now, okay. So say you buy that TV that doesn't come with the glasses. You are going to be dropping at least $150 for glasses. I believe that price is for a pair of glasses. So you're going to be getting two, but still, you're dropping a couple $1,000 on a new TV, and then dropping, say, I mean, I'm a family of four, so if it's $150 a pair, I would be dropping, you know, let's say $2,500 on a new TV, plus $300 at the minimum on 3D glasses. And I say the minimum because if I want anybody else to come over and enjoy my new 3D TV set, I have to buy glasses for them too. If you want to have a Super Bowl party and watch your Super Bowl in 3D, you have to have a pair of glasses for every person that comes to that party. And that can get awful expensive based on some of the Super Bowl parties that I've been to with, say, 20, 25 people. That's just not possible. It's not reasonable. It's not feasible. Something else I think is that not all 3D glasses will be working on all the different 3D sets. Different manufacturers are using different methods to display their 3D, and as such, their glasses are different. So glasses for TV set A may not work on TV set B. There's no guarantee that if you and your buddy both have a 3D TV set, your glasses are going to work on his set, and there's no guarantee that his glasses will work on your set. I think one of the other problems I have with the 3D TV is that you really have to be sitting directly in front of the TV to get that real effect. If you're sitting off to the sides, you're screwed. If you're lying down, it's not going to look all that great. So I can't lie down, and like I said, heaven forbid you're off to the side, because you're going to be getting an awful, blurry mishmash of god-awfulness. Now, I think the last thing about the glasses I want to rant about is that they're freaking battery power. Just what I need in my house. Like, 6 or 8 more things that need batteries changed. You couldn't have put some sort of charger on them where I plugged them in at night and they charge, but no. You rush to get the damn things out the door, so of course the cheaper way to do it is to make them battery powered. Right. Because, like, I don't spend enough money a month on freaking batteries. I need to add more things to my list of things that require batteries in my household. That's gonna be it, guys, for Tech Lust and Tech Left in the Dust. Thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. A couple quick things before we go. I just want to say thanks again for listening. The audio for this show was pulled off of PodSafe Audio, www.podsafeaudio.com. The intro track is Schrodinger's Cat Paradox by C-Jax. The closing music is Anhelos, the remastered version by Leechmaster. If you like what you hear on the Dow of Tech and you need more of a fix on me, please follow me on Twitter. I am twitter.com/MarkPrestash, MarkPrestash. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, insults, or praise, please feel free to email me at daospotting@gmail.com. That is taospotting@gmail.com. Now, don't forget, guys, listen all the way through after the music, because I'm going to be playing the promo for HG World. I hope you guys have a good week, and I will talk to you all later. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
The sun sets on the old world. Change is inevitable. It took a year for the virus to take over the world, and a day for it to change mine completely. For nearly a year, I have lived out here, among the dead, running, and hiding from their insatiable appetites. I have seen and done things that will haunt me for as long as I live. I pray on the day my sun sets that I can enter the twilight free of the disease that would make me rise again, so I don't come for you in the night. Join me as I fight to survive in season 1 of Edgy World, coming this spring from 3015th North Studios, available on iTunes, Zune, anthropodomatic.com. Join the struggle at www.goodmorningsurvivors.com.